Hello, and welcome to Friendly Neighborhood Libertarian. I'm your host, Izzy, and today we have on Mark Friedman, who's a retired attorney doing political theory without a license. Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Hi, Izzy. I'm doing fine. Looking forward to our discussion.
So we're going to be talking about your book, Libertarian Philosophy in the Real World, right?
Correct.
Okay. So I guess the first thing that I'm noticing a lot of is that you try to ground your libertarianism primarily in justice. Why is justice important, and why is Nozick's approach to justice a strong approach?
Sure. As a procedural point, I have no problem with multi-part questions. But if I go astray, I may have to ask you to repeat one of the multiple parts if I wander too far off into the woods. So I'll rely on you to do that. The answer to the first part of your question is morality is important. Morality imposes certain obligations on all moral agents, and justice is an essential component of morality generally. And it governs the rights that human beings have against each other, which in turn governs the obligations of the state with respect to the guardianship of such rights. In terms of Nozick's philosophy, I think it's persuasive because it's consistent with some fundamental notions we have about respect for persons. What is proper to do to another person in terms of coercion, fraud, things of that nature? And that goes, I think, at least further back than Kant, but Kant was probably the most eloquent exponent of it in terms of his precept that you can never treat other human beings solely as a means. You have to always treat them as an end in themselves. And it might be worthwhile just to rehearse Nozick's argument just a little bit, because it kind of governs everything else in his political philosophy. And it's essentially an argument from the best explanation, which is to say he starts with the observation that we obviously hold human beings to a higher moral status than we do earthworms or chickens or any other known life form. That's the observation. Then the question is, what's the best explanation for that observation? And his answer is the unique characteristic that entitles competent human beings to this elevated status is rational agency, which he defines as free will, moral agency, and the ability to shape and lead our lives according to our own definition of the good and what would constitute flourishing for us. And the next step is, okay, given this characteristic of rational agency, what's the appropriate response from other human beings? And the answer is to respect the autonomy of such agents and not to coerce them, defraud them, commit violence against them, otherwise violate their rights. And that is sort of the mainspring of his entire philosophy.
So, I mean, to follow up on that, why, if I'm correct, Nozick famously doesn't actually explain which human rights are valid. Where would you ground, like, which human rights are valid? Because some people have, like, contested that property rights are valid.
Well, I mean, I think there is a lot of guidance in Anarchy State and Utopia about which rights are actually real and which rights are imaginary. Property rights are an essential component of autonomy. Autonomy is the guiding light. And so we're all what Lauren Lomasky, another libertarian philosopher, describes as project pursuers. What is sort of a hallmark of human beings is we all have things we want to achieve in our lives, whatever that is, to have a cabin in the woods, to travel the world, to raise our families with sufficient resources, you can't do that without property rights. I mean, you have to have resources, unless you're literally a monk that's going to live on just bread and water in some monastery. You're going to have resources to realize these objectives. And so when property rights are not respected, you're interfering in a very fundamental way with people's autonomy. And Nozick has this argument about taxation is on a par with forced labor, which I think is a very strong argument, because he says, look, if it takes me 100 hours to earn $10,000, and the state taxes away that $10,000, it has in effect taxed away the 100 hours of labor I needed to earn that money. So it's robbed me of that portion of my life represented by those hours, and it has interfered in my ability to realize those projects and those objectives that I've set for myself as a rational agent.
Would that only be dealing with ex post confiscation, or would that also apply ex ante? So, like, you know, oftentimes states advertise their like tax rates in advance, and people may have, you know, some choice about whether or not they decide to work at certain places. Does that factor into how legitimate states are? Like, would it be less legitimate for a state to tax after the fact, or would it be the same moral value if they tax before the fact?
Yeah, that's an argument that people make against Nozick. I don't think it's a terribly effective argument, because you can't confront people with two immoral choices and then say, well, I gave you a choice. Either you work as my slave, or I'm going to execute you here on the spot. Well, you have a choice, but you've confronted the person with two immoral choices. And the property rights, I'm assuming for purposes of this discussion, an argument that property rights arise in some just fashion. In other words, I'm not earning my money by violating anybody else's rights. I'm earning it by some capitalist act between consenting adults. And given that premise that he's starting from, I think the, you know, give me 40% of your income or I'm going to throw you in jail, it can't really sanitize the taxation.
Of course, yeah. So I guess that brings up like the question, like, okay, so if taxation is immoral generally, in what situations can justice be overturned for the greater good? And how would this manifest itself in the state?
Okay, just to back up a half step, I think some taxation is legitimate. The state has certain functions that it should provide because there are certain public goods, vital public goods that support rational agency that only the state can provide. And to the extent, and so what libertarians, minimal state libertarians, commonly have in mind by that is national defense and civil and criminal law enforcement, and possibly infrastructure, and possibly keeping helpless people from dire poverty or death if voluntary efforts are insufficient. So just to get that out of the way, there is certain taxation that would be legitimate even under a Nozickian society. But to answer your question directly, I'm a value pluralist, and I think Nozick was a value pluralist, although he's a little bashful about admitting that, which is to say, rights are not the only things that exist in the moral universe. So rights coexist with consequences, with avoiding catastrophic moral outcomes. And Nozick says that. He says, there are side constraints on how you can treat people, including what you can do to their property, but these side constraints might have to be relaxed to avoid catastrophic moral harm, I think is the phrase he uses. So that's in essence recognizing that rights have to coexist and compete in some ways with other moral considerations. So if, for instance, somebody owns a unique piece of property that the state needs for some purpose of overriding national importance, and that person, for whatever reason, refuses to sell it at any price, the state would be justified in seizing that property, paying just compensation, and using the property to avoid the terrible consequences. Similarly, I would say if voluntary efforts have failed and the only choice is some taxation to provide basic necessities of life for blameless people, say children, who have no responsibility for their dire straits, then I would certainly be in favor, and I think even Nozick would be in favor of taxation for that purpose. So rights, I think Nozick would say, and I would agree, that natural rights have a very strong presumption in favor of being upheld, but there are at least some circumstances we can envision where they would be overridden.
Interesting. Like, okay, so following up with that, so you mentioned like principles are important, but you also mentioned that we're in the real world and there is some difficulty with the competing rights and stuff. Should libertarians push for first best solutions or second best, but maybe more attainable solutions? Like, should we vote lesser evil or should we vote libertarian?
Well, those might be two separate questions. The first question, I think, is pretty easy. We should always push for policies and programs that move us towards the libertarian ideal, even if we fall far short of it. So one of the purposes of my book was in each case where I critique the state for having laws that violate libertarian rights, I suggest things that we could do to move us in the right direction, even if they're not optimal. So just to take one example from the book, in the realm of healthcare, it's a crazy patchwork system, some Frankenstein's monster of public and private, the net effect of which is that it's both a disaster from a rights point of view and a utilitarian point of view. But there are some things that are, I think, within the Overton window that we could do that would alleviate at least some of the more egregious harms. For instance, as things now stand in many states, before you can open a hospital or some clinic, you have to get a certificate of need. You have to go to some bureaucrat and get them to approve that there's a need for this facility, this hospital, which clearly seems to offend, market-based outcomes and people's rights. You have situations where a doctor in one state has to jump through a doctor, nurse, physician's assistant who are practicing lawfully in one state. If they move to a different state, there are various regulatory licensing hoops they have to jump through, which makes no sense. You have a situation where an insurance company in one state has to get licensed in 50 states to sell the policies. You have a situation where what most people really need and what makes the most sense is catastrophic coverage, as opposed to coverage for routine care, which is crazy because we don't have car insurance to handle oil changes or new tires. We have insurance to deal with unexpected disastrous outcomes. So there may be policies we could adopt which would move us towards very high deductible plans with health savings accounts, which puts more of the purchasing decision in the hands of consumers and puts market pressure on providers to compete on price. So part of the point of my book is to say, look, there are things we could do without going to Libertopia. There are things we could do to help. In terms of voting, that's an interesting question, which requires a whole bunch of philosophical thought that I haven't really invested the time to give a good answer to, because, I mean, we each have one vote. We're not going to affect the outcome anyway, right? I mean, the odds, I live in Washington State. we're the Washington State is gonna vote for Joe Biden. So my vote is purely symbolic to begin with. So you know, maybe here I should vote my heart, my conscience, to send a signal to the world that libertarians are out there and we count. But if you really think that your vote might have some impact, if you live in a swing state, you know, maybe then you wanna pick the lesser evil. Except if both options are really evil, maybe there's a minimum bar that people have to cross over before they earn your vote. As I said, that I think you're asking a very good question, and I wish I had some better answer. It's just I haven't put in the time to really feel comfortable with it.
That's totally fine. I guess I'm sorry, like a lot of these questions are sort of following up, but I just want to like make sure, like, you know, we're not like immediately changing topics.
Sure.
So that sort of like seems to play into like the idea of minimal constraints about like, or having a bar for how people need to act kind of like begs the question about like what moral obligations a state has. Like, I mean, like, obviously everyone seems to agree, like, concentration camps are terrible and stuff, but, like, is there, like, a distinguishing line beyond certain people, and can the state impose certain types of morality? And if so, what?
Okay, well, I think it's what I was referring to earlier. The state has an obligation, really the only obligation, in my opinion, and Nozick's opinion, that the state has, in moral terms, is to provide the scope of autonomy demanded by rational agents. And the minimal state libertarian position is, as I said, kind of national defense, enforcement of laws, and maybe infrastructure and relief of poverty. That flows directly from this whole idea of rational agency, that if we're all incinerated in a nuclear war, those of us who aren't dead are going to be worried just about survival. So obviously that impinges in the most dramatic way on the scope of rational agency. Similarly, if we have a society where criminals are just allowed to run rampant and to do what they want and to victimize innocent people, there too, rational agency gets reduced to just ensuring the survival of ourselves and our loved ones. So the obligations of the state flow directly from the need to safeguard rational agency. So once we get beyond that, it's very difficult to, once we get beyond that, the only way you can accomplish those subsidiary goals would be through coercion. When you tax people to redistribute from one middle class group to another middle class group, or even worse, from the middle class to the upper class, you're using coercion in an offensive way. I don't think coercion is objectionable when it's necessary for national defense, because everybody, all rational agents, benefit from avoiding a nuclear holocaust. But it can't be said with respect to everything else that we do in the state, like, you know, student loans and housing and all these other things that really have no effect on rational agency. So to get to the second part of your question, I don't think the state has any license to promote morality generally, because that's the whole point of rational agency, is that we each get to define the good as we see fit, as long as we don't try to impose that vision on other people. And so I don't think there's any role for the state beyond the provision of those vital public goods, including potentially, you know, the roads. The great question of how are we going to provide roads and bridges and that kind of stuff. Maybe it's a whole long argument that I won't bore you with, but maybe we need the state at least for the power of eminent domain, because if we don't have that, you would again face some sort of catastrophic moral horror. If we can't move goods from one part of the country to the other, we can't cross rivers because there's no bridges, the utilitarian cost might be so high that coercion would be justified.
Okay, interesting. So you're bringing up the point that like the state basically functions to safeguard like rational autonomy. If that's the case, does the state have any goal in encouraging egalitarianism? And when I'm saying egalitarianism, I'm meaning like a soft form of social justice in that like everyone is like rational enough in that they're being taught the skills to like function in the world.
Well, I mean, I think yes. Within limits, yes, in the sense that children are potential rational agents, and thus children have rights. And normally, because parents brought those children into the world and have love and affection for those children, we would normally assign the responsibility to safeguard the rational agency of those children to their parents, who would be most committed to doing that. But there are irresponsible parents. So the state has a legitimate function in, number one, guarding against externalities, guarding the rights of innocent people. So if a parent was crazy enough to give their kid the keys to the Corvette and say, Johnny, go drive on the interstate and go run an errand for me, well, that's endangering the lives of other people. So, you know, to serve that function, the state could legitimately say, no, you have to be a certain age to consume alcohol. You have to have a certain age for recreational drugs, to own a gun, to drive a car. And if a parent disregards those laws, then it's sort of prima facie an example of child abuse. And then the parent is violating the right of the child. And so then I think the state could step in and remove that child from that household and place it with hopefully another relative, but worst case, and it really is a worst case, the foster care system, to protect the rights of the child. So I think that also has application to education, which may be what you were getting at, that as potential rational agents, children have a right to learn the basic facts about their society and the basic skills that would allow them to be rational agents, which, you know, involves being able to read and write and do at least basic arithmetic. I think parents should be given a lot of flexibility in terms of what that means, because parents are involved in all different professions. They have all different beliefs, some religious, some not religious. So I think parents are entitled to a great deal of flexibility. And, you know, if the parents are envisioning the child maybe as going into a certain profession, a certain occupation, then one set of skills would be appropriate. But if the parents are skilled artisans and they envision their children following in that occupation, then a different set of skills would be relevant. So I think parents are entitled to a lot of flexibility, but nevertheless, I think there's a certain minimal standard. And I think the state could protect the rights of the children in that regard by various ways, either a law that says, look, if your kid reaches the age of 18 and they can't read and write, you're liable for financial, fines or penalties, or even in a worst case, penal sanctions. I think another avenue would be, and maybe it's less intrusive, is to create a tort where once children reach the age of majority, they would have the right to sue their parents for failing to educate them up to some minimal standard. These are imperfect solutions, but I don't think any perfect ones are on offer. The current system is a failure by any objective standard in terms of how much money we're spending and what the outcomes are. And also you have the problem within the public schools of that, their own brand of indoctrination.
I wanted to follow up on that.
If the reason that a parent can't provide a minimally adequate education is simply a lack of resources, they themselves are at the poverty line or below the poverty line, and maybe they themselves aren't educated enough to be a good teacher, then I think, again, under the rubric of protecting the rights of innocent potential rational agents, the state would be justified in taxing people to provide those children with vouchers or other educational options that would get them to the point where they can exercise their rational agency.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, like, around, like, where would this bar be? Like, I know, like, the Amish, for example, in Pennsylvania have, like, a radically different society than us, and they, like, barely teach beyond, like, basic arithmetic. Do you think that that sort of thing would be enough of an intrusion upon children's rights?
That's a good question. And I don't think I can give you like a hard and fast rule of exactly how much arithmetic you have to know. I mean, the Amish are an interesting example that you happen to pick, because at least as I understand it, when the kids get to a certain age, and I think it's 17, although I could be wrong, the norm in that society is to let them loose, let them free, basically say, okay, look, in the next year, you're on your own. I mean, you can visit other communities, you can try out other lifestyles, and then you'll come back and make an informed decision about whether you want to be part of our community or whether you want to pursue a different lifestyle, a different set of values. So the kids are protected in that sense, in that if they sense that they're attracted to these other lifestyles, these other options, they're going to realize, I don't have the skill set to be a computer engineer. So then there's some incentive and some motivation to go get those skills on their own. You know, it's very hard to say. I mean, I think the Amish have a functioning society. I mean, they're not criminals. They're not violating the rights of other communities. Judged on some sort of objective metric, if we can get there, it's an acceptable lifestyle from a libertarian perspective, in that they're doing what they want to do, and they're not making unreasonable welfare demands or otherwise infringing on the rights of other communities. So to bring their children up to fit within that community, which seems to be acceptable under libertarian standards, it seems that they should have some slack, particularly if they're exposing the kids to enough of other lifestyles that the children are able to make some informed decision about whether that fits into their conception of the good. There may be societies and you know, maybe they're very insular, Orthodox Jewish societies that are so insular, and where there's so little exposure and knowledge imparted to those children about what other lifestyle options there are, that maybe the standards have to be a little bit more rigorous in terms of you have to teach some aspects of sociology or history or other cultures, just to make sure that as they go through life, those kids are making some sort of choice, as opposed to just in a soft way, being forced into certain attitudes and beliefs and institutions. It's very hard. It's a very hard issue because it's very easy to then cross the line on the part of the state and say, well, we're going to impose our values on you. You know, we don't like deeply religious communities. And so we're going to, whether we're specifically intending to or not, we're going to undermine your community so that it no longer functions in the way that you want it to. There's definitely a difficult line drawing problem there. But again, there's no perfect outcomes. There's no way to a state-run system where everybody has to go to the public schools and learn what the state decides is the minimum. That has terrible consequences as well. So I think you just have to bear in mind that we're picking between imperfect alternatives.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a really interesting point, and I'm glad you brought that up because I think that's like a really big tension that I think is hard to resolve. In that same question about encouraging rationality, I want to ask about your anti-discrimination chapter. In that you argue that as a result of state-based oppression, that anti-discrimination laws are justified in the short term. I guess my question is how do these provide restitution, and does the state have a role in encouraging rationality through something like this?
Well, I think we have to distinguish between rectification and restitution. And I think the thing I was focused on in the anti-discrimination section was remedying past injustice perpetuated by the state through actual laws, actual Jim Crow laws, which prohibited blacks from doing certain things. And the interplay between this need to rectify a past injustice and the presumption that libertarians normally have about the right of private parties to do business with whoever we like. So the standard libertarian answer is a private party should enjoy freedom of contract. So if for whatever reason, I don't want to sell you flowers or I don't want to take your wedding photographs or whatever, that's my right. Now that has to coexist with the avoidance of grave harm. So you can't have an emergency room where somebody comes in with a gunshot wound and it's life or death, and the physician says, well, I don't deal with Jews, or I don't treat Muslims, or I don't treat black people. That would be totally unacceptable because the utilitarian cost of that is just too high, and people aren't able to seek the alternative emergency room that would be responsive to them in emergency. So that element of free choice is absent. So what I was saying in that subsection is, okay, given this past history of state-created injustice, this normal libertarian presumption in terms of freedom of contract has to go by the wayside. So, you know, we can't have a situation where in the Deep South, after Jim Crow, blacks still can't get loans, they still can't use public accommodations, they still can't get equal education because white people have been conditioned to be hateful of black people. So in that circumstance, I was saying the presumption in favor of freedom of contract has to yield. And that's why the anti-discrimination laws that went into effect in 1964 were justified, even from a strict libertarian perspective. Restitution is a little bit different because there you're talking about monetary compensation or some other form of compensation, not just requiring people not to discriminate, but taxing people in order to try to make right the wrongs that were done to blacks in, for example, the Jim Crow South. So if you have a person, a black person, who has been denied a decent education because of the separate quote, separate but equal high schools and so junior high schools and so on, then when they get to be 18 years old, it's unfair to say to them, well, okay, go out and earn a living, you know, and you're on your own. They've been the victim of discrimination. So in that circumstance, it seems to me the state would be justified in saying, okay, we screwed you. We've screwed you in the past. Now we're going to try to make it right by giving you, you know, X number of years of free education at an institute of your choice, whether it's vocational or college or whatever. We'll try to ameliorate as much as we can the harms that have already been done to you by providing this benefit, whether it's monetary or services in kind, whatever. I think that would be justified under the same principles as I was discussing in connection with rectification. I would just say that the legitimacy of such restitution begins to diminish very substantially over time. So that if you're talking two or three generations down the road, you're no longer talking about a person who has been directly harmed by the discrimination. You're talking about their children or their grandchildren. And on the other hand, you're no longer talking about the people who benefited or who voted for these Jim Crow laws. You're talking about their children or grandchildren who were innocent. We don't typically punish the child for the sins of the father. So the bar becomes harder to leap over the further off in time you get from the injustice. But that was the point I was making about rectification versus restitution.
Excellent. So I guess, like, in the same vein or regarding the same sort of question, well, how important are property rights in this system? So, like, in a system where maybe the person who, like, you know, would have been doing the discriminating didn't end up, like, voting for laws that were in place that, like, discriminated against gay people, for instance, like, how do we weigh property rights? Is it like a presumption in favor of them?
Well, yes. I mean, the quick answer to your question is I think there's a very strong presumption in favor of property rights because of, as I mentioned before, they're a key aspect of our autonomy, and you can't really pursue projects or goals or do the things that are important to you without secure property rights. I'm not sure I understand the connection. If you're talking about anti-discrimination laws in terms of violating property rights, maybe that's a shorthand for freedom of contract, which is a big issue about whether these cases have already come up about whether a florist is required to create floral arrangements for a gay person's wedding, or a photographer is required to render his services at a same-sex couple's wedding. Is that the thrust of your question, or am I missing it?
Yeah, it is the thrust of my question.
Okay. So this gets back to the catastrophic moral horror thing, which is why you can't have emergency rooms or the only hospital on an island, why their property rights don't permit them to not serve, blacks, Jews, Muslims, gays, or whatever, who come to the emergency room in a life and death situation. That's way over the line. But the cases, the notable thing about the cases that have come up, at least from my perspective, is there's no harm being inflicted. Okay, so this baker doesn't want to bake you a custom order cake to celebrate your same-sex union. Okay, there's 10,000 other bakers in this city. Why don't you go to one of those? You know, you want this photographer to memorialize your wedding. Well, and he doesn't want to. Okay, there are plenty of other photographers. So it seems like this is a search for victimhood. This is a way to get back at people with traditional moral or religious views to haul them in front of the licensing authorities and remove their license to do business because they won't violate their conscience and you won't go down the one block over and get the services from some other provider. So in those situations, it seems clear that rational agency permits people to have views that other people find incredibly offensive, as long as those views don't spill over to violence or the denial of very important services that the injured party would have a right to expect. I mean, if I'm the victim of a gunshot wound, whatever my political philosophy or ethnicity or race, I have the legitimate expectation that when they haul me to the hospital, I'm going to get treatment. And the doctor on duty isn't going to say, well, no, I don't deal with Jews. Sorry. But that's certainly not the case in these other contexts.
Excellent. Great. I mean, sticking with the same topic of property rights, but in like a slightly different direction, who provides the property rights in question and how are they done? So, I mean, like the government obviously seems to be like a major progenitor of certain types of property, like deeds and stuff. But in terms of things like homeowners associations, like who is in charge? And if the state is in charge of property and determining it, why are they not also in charge of zoning? Or should they be?
Well, I mean, property rights are moral rights. So the origin is a long involved argument about how property rights get off the ground, which Nozick draws heavily on Locke in terms of saying, okay, if you invest your time and energy in improving property in some fashion, building on it or constructing a mine and mining it, as long as you're not damaging other people by that activity, then you've acquired that property justly. It's the whole homesteading model that Locke drew on. So there's a whole long involved argument that I actually spend much more time in on my first book, which is more of an academic philosophy work than the book that we're talking about. But there's a good argument that property rights are morally legitimate in their origins. And because of that, then other people are required to respect those rights and not simply to take your homestead away from you that you've created by investing your labor in it. So then, to get more directly to your question, the state is required in its role as provider of vital public goods in securing those property rights, just as it's obligated to provide rights of free expression, rights of religious liberty, rights of free association, rights to due process in criminal proceedings. There's a whole panoply of obligations that a legitimate state has to undertake because these are rights that the citizens are entitled to have and to expect the state to vindicate. Homeowners' rights and zoning, zoning is essentially an abomination before the Lord in terms of rights. It just violates rights in every conceivable way, and to boot, has terrible utilitarian outcomes, which I describe in the book in terms of sprawl. You have sprawl, you have people having to travel greater distances to their work, which means that they're driving cars longer distances, which means they're polluting, which means that kids can't attend the school that's best for them, even under the public school system, because you can only attend the school that is in your district, that your district encompasses. So zoning not only violates rights on a wholesale basis, but it also has terrible utilitarian outcomes. The HOAs are different, I think, in that As bad as they may be, it's still a voluntary choice to buy a home or a condo that's governed by an HOA. There are plenty of properties that aren't. Most of the HOAs are on pre-planned, you know, developed communities where the developer, when the community, when the homes in the community went on sale, he created this HOA because he thought it would facilitate the sale of the homes, that people would like to live in a community where there's no noise after 9 p.m., where everybody has to maintain their property, where there's a uniform architectural style, where, you know, you can't paint your house some flaming pink color. Now, you know, I wouldn't want to live under an HOA because I think in large part they unnecessarily restrict your property rights and your freedom of choice. So if I don't want to live in a particular HOA, I buy a property outside of one. And I'm 67 years old and I've yet to live under an HOA because for whatever reason, luck or preference, I've always lived in properties that aren't governed by one. Whereas zoning, I mean, the entire country is subject to zoning. Houston is the only city that I'm aware of that has eschewed classic zoning. In other words, they don't have neighborhoods that are zoned residential, light industrial, manufacturing, but they still have land use restrictions. So there's no way to opt out of zoning like there is with HOAs. And that's why if you're asking me in terms of relative violation of rights, zoning is much more egregious, I think, than the HOA system.
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting to more specifically is the HOA like a violation of rights in the sense that, like, I'm assuming with the, like, zoning, like, going out of the mainstream, like, in a theoretical world, probably you'd see some people wanting to preserve property values, etc. So they might, like, look for these HOA things. If those things became widespread, would they be like less oppressive than the state, or is there like something that's morally relevant that makes the state worse?
I'm not sure I entirely understand the question. The HOA system, you can opt out of it. Obviously, I mean, you know going in. Okay, if I buy this house, it's in a community where there's an HOA. So I'm going to have to live by these rules. Some people may think those rules are great. I think a lot of people are fine with them because, as I said, there may be aspects of the package that they like. They're retired. They like to go to bed at a certain time and be confident that the neighbors aren't going to be playing loud music at 3 a.m. And you know, if the neighbor does, they have an easy remedy in place of, complaining to the board that runs the HOA. That may actually be attractive to people. So it's a choice they're making. Zoning, it's not a choice because you have no alternatives. I mean, we're going to live in a zoned community. We all live, unless you're in Houston, we all live in a zoned community. So there's no way to get out from under it. One seems much more objectionable than the other.
Yeah, I mean, like in terms of like relative competition amongst zoning. So it's not like all like zoning neighborhoods are zoned the same way, right?
Right.
Would the fact that like, you know, different cities have to compete be like, while they still have zoning, would that be like particularly distinct from the homeowners association only in that one of them is voluntary and one of them isn't?
Well, I see your point. I mean, if there were a wide range of zoning alternatives, the system would come to be similar to an HOA and would be less objectionable. But from my reading, zoning is pretty ubiquitous and it's pretty uniform in giving preference to single family homes and restricting duplexes and town homes and multifamily. Now, there is some change afoot in that some cities, at least, I think, are beginning to recognize the deleterious effects of their zoning policies. So there is some liberalization happening. And I suppose if that gets pushed far enough, then you're right. The zoning laws would come to resemble HOAs, and that you would have a much greater choice of where to live. But the point I make in the book, which I think is key, is that we don't need zoning. It's a more or less bad outcome. Different zoning schemes are more or less bad, but they're all terribly worse than simply doing away with zoning. Because one of the lessons that I think this guy Ellickson argued for is that you get a spontaneous order. If you just look at European cities or other environments where you don't have zonings, you don't get a massive oil refinery located next to residential homes. Because when you go to build a huge oil refinery or a huge factory, you look for a bunch of things that you're not going to find in Pacific Palisades or Beverly Hills. You look for, you want to be near a port. You want to be near rail junctions. You want to be near major highway routes. So there's a logic to why things get located in certain places and why residential uses tend to segregate from commercial uses, and why once you get restaurants located in a certain neighborhood, then you get entertainment. You get jazz clubs, you get music clubs, because after dinner, people want to go and be entertained. And there's there's an emergent order that you get that actually works better and preserves people's freedom of choice in a far better way than these just arbitrary zoning standards. And when people are worried about, without zoning, my neighbors will just be able to do whatever they want and I won't have a remedy, that's false, because the tort of nuisance is still good law, and very well developed corpus of the law of nuisance back before we had zoning. So that you look at things like what was there first. So if a farm is there and operating, and there are cattle on the farm or on the ranch, and people buy homes next to it, they can't complain, there are terrible odors, because you moved to those odors. There was a whole body of law that governed permissible versus impermissible activities that was in place before we came up with the zoning. So the real answer I have is, let's do away with zoning altogether. It'll be better from a variety of perspectives. But to get to your point, yes, if we had more flexible types of zoning, it would indeed begin to resemble HOAs in terms of having more freedom of choice.
Excellent. I have a couple more questions for you. Thank you so much so far. I'm really appreciating your clarity and insight. If your defense of liberty is largely couched in people being rational, does proving that people are irrational provide the primary justification for the state? And how does this interact with a control over the elderly and children?
Okay, I think it's important to distinguish between rationality and rational agency. Rationality is something I think that we honor more in the breach than in the observance. I don't think there are any Dr. Spocks, Mr. Spocks among us. I mean, we're not rational in the sense of being calculating beings, of weighing every decision in some logical way. We've all, I'm sure, acted in ways that not only were irrational, but that were pretty stupid in retrospect. So rational agency is much different. Rational agency is a set of capabilities that we all actually do have. We all have free will. We all competent adults are moral agents. And we all have the capability of planning our lives in accordance with some set of values or some set of goals that we ourselves select. So we're all rational agents. Very few of us are rational in any rigorous sense at any particular time. So the argument for respect for autonomy doesn't depend on any claim that people are actually rational. And I'm sorry, can you give me the second part of that question?
Yeah. So does the, and I'm gonna say relative irrationality, I mean, like in the sense that people are less able to be rational agents, does that provide a claim for the state to have some control over the very elderly and children?
Yes, because the children are only potentially rational agents. They're not. And as we discussed before, in light of that, the absence of that attribute in a, you know, four-year-old, the state does have a role in safeguarding that potential, as we discussed, in terms of both guarding against externalities and guarding against child abuse. The elderly are a little bit different because typically a person will, if they're thinking about it at least, will fill out a healthcare proxy and a power of attorney so that if they become unable to make rational decisions, they've entrusted that to their offspring or to a trusted friend or even to an institution that's set up to provide that service. If they haven't, then in terms of protecting that person's rights, I think we would normally look to, if that person has failed to sign a healthcare proxy or failed to sign a living will or a power of attorney, we would naturally look to a spouse or to a child as the person that's most likely to know what that person's wishes would be if they were able to express them. As a fail-safe, if none of that works, then yes, I think we would have no choice but to entrust the state to safeguard the wishes of the elderly.
Interesting. Great, thank you. So how does libertarian, or we have a question before that about this. Like, how do you classify a child though? Because it seems like the concept of what it means to be a young person has changed a lot over like the past 100 years. Where like my great grandfather like dropped out of like middle school to work at like a pencil factory, and for all practical purposes, he was an adult. But we don't consider like a 13-year-old today to be an adult. Like, where do we, like, how do we determine what makes someone a kid and unable to be rational?
Well, that's an excellent question, and obviously the answer is dependent on each individual. There are certainly 13-year-olds that have adult-like capabilities in terms of making good choices, and there are 30-year-olds who don't. But unfortunately, legislation has to paint with a broad brush. You can't have an individual rule for each minor child. You have to say, okay, the age at which you can drive a car is X, and that's going to be over-inclusive and under-inclusive. There are some people that could probably drive a car at safely at 14, and other people who shouldn't be put behind the wheel at the age of 30. But you can't have, you have to have a law that's enforceable, which means you have to have some objective standard. But I mean, the point is certainly valid in that you'd have to weigh each person individually in terms of making moral judgments, but in terms of making a legal judgment, I mean, it could come into play in terms of when the state investigates a family or parents for child abuse. You could certainly, I think, a parent could say, no, it was not child abuse because my particular child was old enough to make a rational choice And therefore, it was responsible on my part to let them make that choice, as opposed to a different child that needed parental involvement until they were 18. So there probably is some room for individual evaluation, but as a general rule, you're going to have a bright line in order to have legislation. But I agree with you. The way children were viewed 100 years ago is dramatically different than the way they're viewed today.
Okay. My next question is, how does libertarian paternalism interact with your system? Should people be able to be nudged towards better systems? You mentioned earlier on, like, health savings accounts. Is, like, broadly pushing people by the government to do good things but not forcing them acceptable?
The short answer is no. This whole libertarian paternalism, I think, is a contradiction in terms. The classic example that's given is the 401k program, where people do themselves a disservice by not availing themselves of the matching funds. So Sunstein and Thaler say, okay, we should make it the default option that employees are automatically enrolled in the 401k unless they opt out of it. I think that's a legitimate point, but it's not paternalism, because the sponsor of that plan is an employer, and the employer is offering it as a perk to get people to work for them. And they're using their money to administer the program and to fund the program. So naturally, since it's a private program run by a private company, they have the right to set the terms. And if they want to do their employees, a favor by having that as the default option, then I think they're perfectly entitled to do that. And maybe it's laudable for them to do it. But it's not a case of paternalism. It's a case of the private party exercising their property rights to set up the program as they see fit. But in the other examples they use of having fast food restaurants not serve soft drinks of more than a certain size, or having disclosures on the walls about our Big Mac has so many calories, then it's just a classic case of coercion, where that's not a vital public good. It's not within the ambit of state authority, as I've defined it, as libertarians define it. So it's not libertarian. It's paternalism. It's coercive, but it's not libertarian paternalism. It has nothing to do with libertarianism. The question about the HSAs, I guess, is interesting, because I think it crosses the line when the state is using tax incentives to push one program as opposed to another, because in effect it's using the tax system, which is coercive, to achieve certain goals that aren't being freely selected by taxpayers. But with the HSA thing, we have this crazy system in place where and it's an artifact of World War II, where employers were prohibited by the government from paying their workers more than a certain amount of compensation. So in competing with workers, they were able to, under the tax code in place at the time, and it's continued, they were able to say, well, okay, instead of paying you more money as compensation, we'll take care of your health care. And so you have this crazy system where if the employer sets up this insurance program, they get to deduct all the expenses as a business expense. So it lowers their taxes. But if I'm just a taxpayer and I want to enroll if I want to buy catastrophic insurance or enroll in some HSA program, I don't get the same tax benefit. So what I'm talking about in the HSA is level the playing field. And don't use the coercive powers of the state, but simply give the private parties the same liberty, the same tax advantage as is enjoyed by employers under this legacy from World War II.
Cool. Great. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of people seem to think that, like, a lot of failures at the healthcare market are largely due to private markets, when that really isn't the case.
No, that's crazy. This is a very good point. I'm glad we have an opportunity to talk about it. About half of every healthcare dollar is spent by the government through either the Veterans Administration, Medicare, or Medicaid. And about 90%, this is really the critical blow your mind number, 90% of all the healthcare dollars are spent either from the proceeds of insurance or these government expenditures. So only 10% of every healthcare dollar is spent out of pocket, where a consumer has to bear the direct cost of the choice that they're making. And this is low even by the standards of other developed countries, including those that have universal coverage. Because when you're shopping for healthcare and you have to reach into your own purse or wallet and pay for it, you're going to look around and find something that's cost effective. Just as when I need to change the oil in my car, I live in some relatively small town. There's probably a dozen places in this town where I can get my oil changed. And since it's a relatively fungible service, they have to compete. And so it's a pretty reasonable cost. And I know the cost, and I can weigh the advantages and disadvantages of various providers. But in the health insurance market, once I've hit my deductible, most people, once they've hit their deductible, then the healthcare insurance pays for 80%. So imagine what kind of car I could buy, or what I would buy, if somebody else was paying 80% of it. Instead of buying a Subaru, I'd buy a Ferrari, whether the Ferrari was giving me any great benefit or not. And the decisions you make, if I'm part of a insurance plan where I've got 1,000 other employees, my utilization has no impact on the cost of my insurance in the following year. Whereas if I was evaluated on an individual basis, we would take that into account. And again, I would bear the costs of my choices, and the providers would have to compete for my dollars. So nothing could be further from the truth than to blame the healthcare mess on free market capitalism, because our system is about as, apart from whatever they have in North Korea, our system's about as far away from free market capitalism as you can imagine. And it's just a nightmare.
Great. So I want to go to the final questions, which you pointed out that there's, like, more libertarian plurality on these issues, and that they're a little bit unsettled. Regarding Citizens United and free speech generally, is there a right to anonymous speech, and how much influence can other people have over things that directly coerce other people, like the state?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I have an answer, and the answer is set forth in my book, but it's sort of a wishy-washy answer in a certain sense, in that it depends on certain empirical assumptions. So, to start with, we have the secret ballot. Why do we have the secret ballot? We have the secret ballot because we feel that voting is a matter of individual conscience, and that people shouldn't be coerced to vote in a certain way because their spouse will be all over them, or their employer will be all over them, or their church group will be all over them. We have, I think, the correct view that once you fill out your absentee or paper ballot or go into the voting booth, whatever it is these days, it's your free choice and it's nobody else's business. So then the question is, why should spending money on political advertisements be different? Now, arguably, it's simply the same logic. Why should it be anybody else's business who I'm purchasing advertisements for. If I'm Jeff Bezos and I want to spend $10 million trying to promote, to pick a more controversial case, to try to elect Trump, why should my business suffer because everybody says, oh, I'm not buying from Amazon anymore because Jeff Bezos is supporting Trump or some other unpopular person or cause? Why should he bear that impact? Now, if Jeff Bezos were contributing the same $100 million to the Democrat or Republican Party, I think there would be a good case for disclosure because at least arguably, that politician is going to be beholden to Jeff Bezos and Amazon. So other members of society probably have a legitimate interest to know who's funding these candidates, because it's not unreasonable to think that the people that are funding them are going to have a great deal of influence over the policies that those politicians adopt. But if it's just a private party, and I'm not contributing it to one of the major parties, and I'm not coordinating with those major parties, and I'm just exercising my First Amendment right to speech, I'm not sure why I shouldn't be able to do it anonymously. Now, as I said, this is subject to certain empirical assumptions, one of which is the private party funding of speech is not going to so warp the marketplace of ideas that we're going to get tragic outcomes. And my starting point is to be very skeptical of that possibility, because we have a lot of billionaires, fortunately, in this country, who are billionaires because they provided goods or services that a lot of people want to buy. And these billionaires have a lot of diversity in terms of their political views. So if there's Jeff Bezos over here spending $100 million to promote a certain set of ideas, we could have a Mr. Koch over here spending $100 million to promote the opposite ideas, and you still get a marketplace of ideas, and you still get the public exposed to all the arguments. And at least sort of superficially, you could say the more information that's out there, the better. The more points of view are expressed, on TV, radio, the internet, the better off society is, because the better informed we are. Maybe Jeff Bezos has some particular point of view that nobody else is going to express in the same way, and we'll all benefit from hearing it. By the same token, maybe Mr. Koch will have a different, interesting point of view that will also benefit us. So I'm making certain assumptions about how unlimited free speech rights would operate in the real world. And I could be convinced that there would be such an imbalance of power, or it would work in some unanticipated way, so that the whole ability to, the rule of law would be jeopardized. If you could show me in one way or the other that the rule of law would be in serious jeopardy by unlimited private political speech, then I could be convinced to change my mind.
Excellent. My next non-doctrinaire question is the concept of war. Does the government have a legitimate right to also stop trade with authoritarian governments? And if so, what are they allowed, or should they be allowed, to do? Like, a lot of neoconservatives argue that it is okay to wage war for democracy and freedom. Is that justifiable? And if that is justifiable or not, like, how does that have to do with trade?
Okay. I think that the trade question is relatively easy, at least from my perspective. So imagine it's 1941, and we haven't entered the war yet because Pearl Harbor hasn't happened. And the Nazis are planning the Holocaust, and they're running short of Zyklon B. But fortunately for the Nazis, Dow Chemical Company is able to produce Zyklon B in vast quantities. And Dow, for its own financial reasons, is more than happy to sell that death gas to the Nazis. Should we simply say, okay, it's fair trade, we're not going to interfere? I think the answer is obvious because I think liberal democracies have at least, you know, some interest and some right to protect human rights abroad. And obviously restricting the sale of poison gas to the Nazis, or if Boeing wanted to sell the Nazis bombers in 1941, given how the Nazis were already using bombers, we would be justified and should restrict trade to that regard. That's a whole different thing from the question of humanitarian interventions, which I'm happy to talk about, but which I think is a different subject. But to get back to the narrow focus on trade, so speaking more broadly, I think there are certain cases which are easy, like Boeing selling bombers and Dow selling poison gas to the Nazis. I think there's a broader discussion, which is that trade can be viewed as a legitimate tool of foreign policy. So there are aggressor states out there, and those aggressor states want to wage war against peace-loving states. And in order to do that, they have to have a certain level of economic power. They have to accumulate a certain ability to accumulate war materials and other things that they would use to perpetrate their aggression. So if we, assuming we are a liberal democracy and a peace-loving country, so you don't necessarily have to assume that I'm talking about the United States, although I think I am, but pick whatever country you think is a peace-loving democracy and ask whether that peace-loving democracy would be entitled to limit the economic might of an aggressor state so as to make it less likely that that state would invade a neighboring peace-loving state, I think the answer is yes, that's a legitimate tool of foreign policy. And the moral defense of it would be something like the doctrine of double effect, which governs conduct in war. So if you're at war with your enemy, and your enemy has elected to locate a very valuable military asset in a densely populated city, the question is, can you go after that military asset knowing that given the imprecision of your munitions, innocent civilians are inevitably going to be killed in your bombing campaign? I think most philosophers would say yes, invoking the doctrine of double effect, meaning my aim is to win the war against this aggressor state. To do that, I have to bomb these high-value military targets. That's my objective. Unfortunately, the consequence of pursuing this legitimate objective is that there are going to be civilian casualties. I think most people would say, in a life or death struggle with an enemy, you're entitled to do that. So by analogy, trade would be subject to the same argument. My goal is to diminish the power of an aggressive state to do mischief. The way I do that is to try to limit the economic power of this rogue state. How do I do it? I embargo them so that they don't have the financial resources necessary to construct nuclear bombs or conventional weapons. The unintended consequence of this is that the civilians in that state suffer from hardship. Now, normally you would exclude food, medicine, basic housing materials. You would exclude that as we customarily do from the boycott. But at least in general, in principle, I see no problem why you can't use trade as an aspect of foreign policy, recognizing that this will often be abused and states will often act beyond their authority as they do in everything else. But as a moral principle, I think it's legitimate.
So I guess my question more specifically is about measuring an economic development versus some slavery stuff. So, like, I was looking at, like, countries like Yemen, and, like, slavery is not completely eradicated there. And not necessarily relating to war, because it's not like the U.S. has strategic interests there. There is a bit of a challenge in that, like, you know, doing free trade might economically empower people, but it might also be used to, like, bolster slavery. Is there, like, a similar sort of objection there?
Yeah, I mean, the liberal state is obligated to protect the negative rights of its own citizens. I think it has some discretion to protect the rights of citizens in other countries, usually not by military means. And the objection to humanitarian military interventions is you're taxing people in your liberal democracy not to provide a vital public good to them, but to help people in a different society. So you're trying to accomplish a noble goal by coercive means, affecting people who aren't going to get the benefit of this humanitarian intervention. But in terms of trade policy and things like that, you're not necessarily coercing members of your own society. You're having policies with respect to other countries. And so, you know, if you're asking, could we say to Yemen, if you want free trade with us, you have to treat your own people better. I think that's really a tactical decision. I mean, if we're reasoning correctly, and if denying them trade would incentivize the rulers of that country to be more liberal, then I think it would be a legitimate decision. If it's going to have the opposite effect, then we probably shouldn't do it, because not only are we not going to achieve any liberalization, we're going to make those people worse off.
Great. Well, thank you for an expansive answer. I have one last question for you. So legitimate civil disobedience was not touched upon in this book. So are we constrained to follow the rules of the state? And if so, or if not, which ways are we allowed to act?
Yeah, that gets into very deep waters in terms of questions of political authority, which is usually couched in terms of do we have any obligation to obey the state just because it's the state? In other words, if the state asks us to do something that we in full rational mode, after deeply considering all the arguments, we regard as immoral, should we do it just because it's a law of the state? And I think the answer is no. But that doesn't dispose of your question, really, because there are prudential reasons why, at least in a liberal democracy, you want to confine protests and political activity to nonviolent means. Because if the overall objective is to have a polity that is as rights respecting as possible, telling people, okay, if you deeply object to a particular law, you're licensed to use violent means to change that law, that's a formula not for a rights respecting society, but a violent, chaotic, anarchist society where rights will not be respected. I mean, imagine if people thought, and you endorsed a moral rule which was widely accepted, that, you know, if you think abortion is murder, is the equivalent of murder, then you're entitled to blow up abortion clinics and murder abortion doctors and other workers who are, employees of that clinic. Or if you're committed to the pro-life position, that you're therefore entitled to preemptively murder those who are fundamentally pro-life. I mean, it's a formula for a civil war, and that's not the only issue that could provoke that kind of violence. I mean, you know, talking about gun rights or hate speech or a bunch of other things where you're going to have deeply committed people trying to get their way by killing either agents of the state or those who disagree with them. So at least in a liberal democracy where there are avenues open to you to effect reform through peaceful means, I think we're obligated to use those. It gets a little more complicated as you move away from a liberal democracy towards what they have in, you know, Zimbabwe or Venezuela or North Korea, where there are no rights to begin with. It's not like violence is going to result in North Korea being less respectful of rights. It's already at zero. It's hard to get to a negative number. So there's less to lose by using violence from a libertarian perspective in a society that already is grossly violating all your rights. So and obviously there are a million shades of gray between, you know, pick your favorite country, Switzerland, Norway, Canada, whatever you think is the society that's most respectful of rights, and where we are in North Korea. There's a million shades of gray in between. So the tactics that would be legitimate would probably vary with the nature of the society and also would vary with respect to the issue. Are we talking about, I have a profound objection to recycling? Well, the tools that might be legitimate in opposing recycling might be different than if we're talking about some sort of profound racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, where people's most profound rights are at stake. You'd have to look not just at the nature of the society, I think, but the nature of the right that's being threatened. And somewhere in that matrix, you get the right answer, but obviously it's going to resist kind of hard and fast rules.
Great. Thank you so much for explaining that and for being an insightful and witty guest and for being our first guest. I had a really good time talking to you, and I hope you have a nice rest of your week, Mark.